From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscoen, and this is Fresh Air. I'm holding down the fort while Terry Gross is attending the annual meeting for public radio people in San Francisco. On this edition of Fresh Air, I talk with one of today's most beloved authors of children's books, Maurice Sendak. Sendak recently took on a weighty task, illustrating the first new Grimm's fairy tale in a century and a half. Also today, we meet Richard Wilbur. His poetry has earned him the Pulitzer Prize, the National Book Award, and an appointment as Poet Laureate of the United States. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album from the performer who's been called the poet of the heartland, John Cougar Mellencamp. And film critic Stephen Schiff gives us a first-hand view of this year's Cannes Film Festival. That's all coming up on this edition of Fresh Air. Maurice Sendak began writing stories when he was 9 years old. During high school, he worked for All American Comics, taking Mutt and Jeff newspaper strips and adapting them to comic books. Later on, his willingness to write about painful issues like separation and divorce made him an unusual children's author and a controversial one as well. In addition, several of Sendak's books were banned when they were first published because they included his anatomically correct drawings of naked children. Sendak has won numerous awards for his work, including the Caldecott Medal for Where the Wild Things Are. His other books include Higgledy Piggledy Pop, In the Night Kitchen, and Outside Over There. In the 1980s, Sendak turned his attention to opera. He adapted Where the Wild Things Are into an opera, and he's designed the sets and costumes for such classic operas as Mozart's The Magic Flute. Sendak's latest children's book, Dear Millie, is a recently discovered Grimm's fairy tale for which he did the illustrations. It's the story of a little girl whose mother sends her to the woods to save her from an approaching war. I asked Maurice Sendak how Dear Millie was first discovered.
The way it came about in the world was so fascinating. As a letter sold in Germany by Wilhelm Grimm, his letters are hard to come by, as are his brother's Jakob's. And then to discover that it was more than a letter. It was a letter which had embedded in it an unrecorded fairy tale, a variant. There are many stories about St. Joseph, but this was a variant on that story, I think, especially tailored to the needs of whoever Millie was.
How did you imagine Millie? Because in illustrating the story, you had to imagine who she was.
Yeah. Well, we had to make her up. There was no way, unfortunately, of ever finding out who Millie was. She obviously was a real girl back in 1806 that Wilhelm wrote to. He did write to a number of children. But she obviously meant something special to him. And one can only presume certain things. One can only presume tragedy had struck in some way. One can only presume it may have been a parent. Maybe it was both parents. We don't know. But he's consoling her. And in the opening part of the letter, it's so kind of sweet and clumsy, the way adults are when they're trying to explain something difficult to a child. And then he quits. And says, listen, I'll tell you a story instead, as though the story as metaphor will be clearer to her, which of course it is. Thus, and it's such a compelling story because he's telling her such a hard fact of life and, of course, in romantic style, in early 19th century style, in language we wouldn't use now, but nevertheless as vigorous and perhaps even more honest than language we would use now, he's telling her that there is such a thing as death.
And that's something I think that parents have a very difficult time talking to children about.
Yes, they do, but children do not have a difficult time hearing about it. I mean, kids are interested in that the way they're interested in the food that goes in their bodies, in the sexuality of their lives, in what happens to grandpa and grandma. I mean, they're interested. They don't have the same sentiment or anxiety about these subjects that we have as adults. Of course they don't, because they don't quite see it in terms of their own lives. However, this story represented such a clear and honest approach to the subject that I fell in love with it. Also, the ramifications of the story, that this was yet another war where a mother is gratuitously separated from her child, which is the history of the human race, alas. And one could then graft onto that more contemporary wars, if you will, which I did. I grafted on the Second World War. I grafted on the Holocaust.
Well, there are images of children, and they remind me of the faces of children that you would see in concentration camps.
Or, they are.
Or even grown-ups that you might see, but have that very...
That haggard, worn look, wiped out look. She's granted, Millie is granted a vision in the early part of the book when she's in the woods, and she's granted a vision of the future, and she sees that she is in a long line of abandoned children, that this is a historical fact. That's what was so touching about the book, that not only was it a beautiful tale written at the beginning of the 19th century by a favorite writer of mine, but also it had such contemporary power.
I think I read somewhere that hearing the Klaus Barbie trials, that played into your drawing of the story and kind of worked upon you in, I suppose, the idea of children being the victims of such horribleness.
Yeah. Well, it was during maybe two summers ago that the Barbie trial was on in Paris, and I was working on the book, and of course, like so many people, I was listening. Very disappointed that he didn't get on trial, that he was protected. And then being maddened by what they did get him on, which was the murder of some 40 innocent children who were had safely hidden in a house in a little village in Isieux in France. And just before the war ended, he got them and killed them. And I was so moved by that, and I'm illustrating a book about a little girl who loses her life for no reason, that I incorporated those lost children of Isieux into Paradise, where Millie is, to commemorate them and do them homage.
And Mozart is with them.
Yeah, Mozart is with them because
conducting.
He's my hero.
Yeah.
And he's employed. He's written a little chorale for them. In my own head, I know the music. They're singing. One of my favorite things that Mozart ever wrote is a tiny piece called the Ave Verum Corpus. It's one of the very last things he wrote. It's about all of 2 minutes. And it's the most exquisite religious hymn. And that's what I hear them singing. And it's as though he's written it for the children of Isieux.
Do you have particular, or did you have particular fears of abandonment? I mean, I think all children fear losing their parents. But I think some children fear it more than others.
Well, yes. As you say, it's a natural component of growing up that you're going to worry. You're going to hear of somebody else who lost mommy or daddy. Then doesn't that make you vulnerable? Will you lose mommy? Or if grandma dies, does that mean you die? Of course, it comes on very early. I think it was particularly so in my growing up because I grew up during the Second World War and being Jewish and having parents who just got out of Europe and living through the knowledge of all of my relatives dying. I should say all of my father's relatives dying. It was a constant. And in my house, there was constant mourning all during the 40s. Plus the photographs of children who were my father's nephews and nieces, who were all my age, my brother's age, and my sister's age. And while we lived in America and were safe, they died. And I think that was traumatic. It was meaningless and wild and terribly upsetting. And my memory of those years, unfortunately, are just very long, grief-stricken years with parents who never recovered, never, ever came out of that shock.
Did they talk about their grief? I mean, or was it something that was you could
feel
in the household?
As is typical of these people, they did not discuss it with their children, probably for the same bad reason that they would be sparing us. Mm. I say bad reason because they weren't. Their grief frightened us. Could they have talked about it? It might have made more sense to us. We knew what it was. We knew people were dying because they were Jews. But we didn't know what that had to do with us. Because we felt like Americans. I suppose just as the German Jews felt like Germans. But it wasn't discussed. It was impossible. My parents were typical parents. They did not discuss things with children.
And with your sisters, did you almost mourn together with them, or was it a kind of private mourning?
Well, growing up in the war, the Second World War, was a unique experience for our generation. My brother was in the army. He was... in the Philippines, we didn't hear from him for months. We were terrified he was dead. My sister had married just before the war began, a wonderful, wonderful man who was killed almost instantly in the invasion of Anzio. Yes, the war made a huge dent in our lives and compounded the relationship between my brother and my sister and myself. Happily, he came home safe. But yes, it still is in our lives. It's very definitely in our lives. It comes up frequently, and when I did Millie, it sprang to life as though it had never lain down. So it'll always be there until I die.
And for you, are books like Dear Millie, and I know there's some other ones for you, kind of working out some of these childhood fears? I mean, are these books a kind of exorcism for you of the fears?
Not consciously. I don't do a book to work out childhood fears. That's a therapeutic business, which you should do in your analyst office, which I did in my analyst office for many years. But no, they are creative impulses. They take on dramatic impact and excitement, and you want to express them on paper. You don't think of them as, exorcising. They do, in fact, but that isn't your primary purpose. That's along the way. That's the good you get out of it. That's the byproduct. But then again, that's true of all works of art and of any artist that ever lived, that where else does it come from but from their innermost souls, if you wish, and in expressing it. And if you're real and if you're getting the real stuff out, well, then you're going to deal with yourself in some very primary process way, and you're going to get something. It may not make you happy, but you're going to find something out.
My guest is writer and illustrator Maurice Sendak. You were a frail child, I mean, a sickly child,
yeah.
as I understand.
Yeah.
Did you think that made you particularly vulnerable then to, I suppose, events going on in the world where if you don't feel strong, maybe you feel like you can't quite cope with what might happen?
Well, I knew that I was vulnerable to death. I knew that. And I was not, you know, not uncommon in those days. We're talking about the 30s when there weren't sulfa drugs or penicillin, and childhood ailments were lethal. And you could die from pneumonia and whooping cough and scarlet fever. Occasionally, children still do, unfortunately. So that I was probably one of many children who was afflicted with a series of these devastating illnesses, which probably led me to have a weak heart, which brought on a coronary in my late 30s. So that you had a strong sense of impermanence. From early, you couldn't have translated that into death. That would have been meaningless, but you were in a state of alarm, and you knew your parents were in a state of alarm, and you knew that somehow you were more vulnerable to something, and that you were especially taken care of. I was lucky because I had two older siblings, my brother being 5 years older, my sister 9, were like a double set of parents, and they surrounded me, you know, and my brother became my very best friend, and I have happy memories of illness with him sitting, drawing pictures and cutting them out and amusing me. I don't have unhappy memories of being sick, oddly enough.
But you spent time in bed. I mean,
yeah,
in those days, children were sick in bed.
Oh, yeah, you were isolated from the family, and the only bit of life you had was looking out the window. It's by no accident that my first book was called Kenny's Window, which I wrote in 57 or something. That was my life, observing other children from the window. I remember I've been quoted saying this, but it was so significant and funny when I was looking at kids with sleds out in the street. And I said to my father, can I someday go out and have a sled? And he said, it would be nice if we could, but being you, you'd probably catch pneumonia. Mm. So there was this rather untactful reminder always of my frailty, you know.
Did you also hear these children? Because as you described that, I could hear them playing.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, one of my favorite occupations was when my grandmother came to stay with us. And she would hold me up on her lap at the window. And then she pulled the blind down, the window shade down. And we'd make believe that it was sort of like a movie because everything would change.
Against it.
And I remember a very particular moment when my sister and brother were in the backyard and they were building a snowman. I could almost see them. And they waved from downstairs and she suddenly pulled the blind down. And then, boom, she pulled it up again and my sister and brother were not there. And it was like a tableau vivant. It was like a movie. They were there, they were not there. And so there were games played at the window that were memorable.
When did you start to draw?
About then. I mean, I copied my brother primarily. Being the second son, you were constantly battling to be as good as the first son. And he was smart, and he did well in school, and he drew. And, of course, I loved him, and I passionately hated him all at the same time. And I wanted to do what he did. I copied his drawings, and he wrote stories, which I would illustrate, bizarre stories, which you couldn't publish now. They were so bizarre. But the business of illustrating began very early, in the sick bed, with storytelling and writing and drawing pictures. And that's how it all started.
And can you see, when you look at your work now, a kind of early beginning of the kind of style that you use? I mean,
no, look at Dear Millie, see nothing. I mean, my early style was lugubrious and terrible. I'm not being modest, it was. I had no training whatsoever. I didn't want to be trained. I did very badly in school. I was one of those kids who doesn't do well in a competitive situation like a classroom. So I refused to learn, even when it was something I liked, like drawing. I had to do it by myself, which I'm not describing as a virtue, it just was the way. And when I first went out looking for work, and my first drawings were incredibly bad, mostly my model was Disney. Those are the things that I saw, Disney cartoons. Everybody had huge yellow shoes, if not black ears. Dear Millie is a long ways from where I was, because it was a long apprenticeship, really learning by sheer dint how to draw.
More with author and illustrator Maury Sendak after we take this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Maury Sendak is my guest. I know that the Lindbergh kidnapping was something that was very frightening for you, and I imagine for all children growing up in that time, which I suppose had a kind of innocence, a kind of carefree feel to it, to think that a child was not safe in their own bed and that somehow a stranger could come and whisk you off. And your book Outside Over There is really a reworking of some of those early feelings.
Well, go back to what we were talking about, of being vulnerable and ill when you're a child and uncertain of your existence, and then the most famous child in the world is taken away, healthy, beautiful, blue-eyed, blonde-haired baby boy who is the apple of everybody's eye, who was our version of Prince Charles, as close as we ever got. It's hard to resurrect that time and what it meant. It was the Depression. It was the beginning rumbles of the war. And the horror of that experience, the terror of that experience, that almost every child would have felt. I particularly so, because it's almost as though I depended on his coming back alive for my own survival. It was a strange feeling, and I remember it. I remember the headlines. I remember the radio accounts. I remember Mrs. Lindbergh's tearful voice on the radio. And I remember us all holding our breath, convinced that, of course, he would be well and sound, because nothing could happen to such a child, and, of course, he was found dead. It was a terrible experience.
You've said one of the curses of my profession is I remember everything. Do you?
That's true. Yeah, I do. I do remember everything.
And I guess
except important things, like where is my wallet, where is my keychain, and what am I supposed to do today? But on the personal level, I do. I mean, memories flood me, and they don't get soft with time. They just remain vivid. It's tiring. It's very tiring.
Do you remember things like gestures and those small moments that seem to be filled with feeling and with importance?
Not all, but probably like you and most human beings, you remember an odd assortment, sometimes very insignificant memories. It's very strange, the ones that are chosen to be recollected. They aren't the big moments. They're often the very small moments. But yes, when I remember them, I can see my father moving, or I can see my brother gesturing, or I can see my mother leaning over a table, and I can recreate it. Yeah, I do.
Do you feel you write for children? I mean, you write with children in mind, or are you really writing for yourself? Because I don't think you're not the way a sort of typical children's author.
I'm not writing at all with children in mind. But I am writing apparently for children, although that isn't what my intention was. It's a good intention. They're the best audience in the world. But if I am writing for children, it's sheer accident. I don't know how come. It's apparently the only way I can write. My gift is very tailored in a very specific shape. I can't write a Norman Mailer or a Saul Bellow type book. You know.
Have you tried?
And no, I haven't tried because I have a very, I think, pretty shrewd sense of my limitations and what I can and cannot do. I don't try. I have no ambitions to write a grown-up book, so to speak. I think I say in my books grown-up things, but I say them in a way that is significantly different from other middle-aged writers. But I don't know why. I can't explain that. I've often finally decided it was in the wiring when you're being shaped as a fetus that it occurs there, that you come out. It's something I've long thought about, and it's something I've never understood.
Do you like to be around children? I mean, do you like the kind of hubbub when children are around?
No, not particularly. And I'm as fussy with the kinds of children I'm around as I am with the adults, because I'm afraid childhood is not an umbrella that makes all of them wonderful. There are as many tedious children as there are tedious adults. And so finding the lovely, wonderful, you'll find more children. Yes, there are more children that are less tedious than there are adults. But the ones that are wonderful are supremely wonderful and very touching. And I've had children in my life and in my family, and I don't have children of my own.
Did you ever want children?
Did I want? Yes, I did. We all do when we're young. But I'm very grateful now at 60 that I didn't do it. I steal everybody else's children. All my friends who have had their children and completely messed up their lives, I now become the good uncle. So I have a bunch of nice kids who come to me.
So you give them back.
I have usurped children. Occasionally I give them back.
And do children try to find you out? I mean, do you get letters from children? Do they try to contact you?
I get letters from children. They don't try and find. Children have a whole different set of values. They are not impressed by stars at all. They don't want to meet you. Only their parents think they want to meet you. I have suffered. My ego has suffered terribly from those autographing sessions where little kids are pushed forward after waiting on a line for an hour when they desperately have to go to the bathroom to meet a short, bearded man. They don't know who the hell he is or could care less. And the mother is saying, honey, this is the man who wrote your favorite book. And you see the expression on their face saying, what does that mean? What does he have to do with my favorite book? They don't make these connections, which their parents think they do. And then the book is shoved at me, and I'm told to write his name or her name and my name, and they've been brought up to never scribble in the book. And here a perfect stranger is writing in their book. And so they're offended, they're tired, they're miserable.
They have to go to the bathroom.
And they have to go to the bathroom, they take it out on you, and they start screaming and crying, and you get reaction like a little girl once looked at me and screamed, he's too short. You know, took a lot of willpower not to straighten her out. I don't hang out with kids. I don't. That isn't my business. When I lecture, I much prefer going to colleges and universities and talking to young artists, writers, theatrical people who are getting into the business where I can be of use to them as a guy who's been in the war and tell them what it's like. Children, the books, that's what I do for them, and I think that is the best I can do for them, and I think my physical presence is a confusion, offers them up no pleasure whatsoever. And they tend to really want to be entertained, and that's not what I do.
Well, my favorite book, not just of what you've written, but I think almost all-time favorite book, is Where the Wild Things Are. And I, even just almost the placement of the words and how you move through the pages has this terrific kind of rhythm. And I must say, when I get to the last line, which is, and it was still hot, talking about the cereal, I am moved to tears. And there's something about that last line that... Well, I guess that's where the love is, in the sense that he was a bad boy, and mm-hmm. he went on this fantasy.
And he was loved anyway.
And he was loved anyway.
Yeah.
And it's a very reassuring last line.
I think so. The book is was 25 years old last year. Yeah. It's wonderful to have lived to see its 25th anniversary and to have enjoyed it. It started out as a notorious book, which was hugely condemned when it was published. And I've lived to see it become a, quote, classic. That's fun. Max and his cuckoo friends are establishment figures at this point. And that's nice, but it was hard-earned. It was very hard-earned.
Are you surprised that your books started out being controversial, and In the Night Kitchen is another one? You see the little boy's penis.
Yes, oh well, yes, that was the first live penis, so to speak, in Kiddie Bookland.
Yeah.
I didn't know that when I did it. I assumed everybody knew about such things. But no, I didn't set out to be notorious, nor did my editor, Ursula Nordstrom, at Harper's. We set out to do books that I wanted to do, and she, as editor, was there to help me do them. We never thought of them as breakthrough books or scandalous books. That was never our intention. It was always to our chagrin and grief that when they were published, they came out to such disorderly noise. It was nonsense. It was just ridiculous that In the Night Kitchen was kept out of any number of libraries in America because of his nakedness, and they had to paint a diaper on him in order for, I mean, that was much kinkier than merely his sex organ. Strange.
Are you, I know that you work in opera and you have a variety of interests, including set design. What kinds of things are you working on now?
I'm working on a bunch of things right now. I'm working on two screenplays. I wrote a screenplay based on a very early book of mine called Very Far Away, which I wrote after Kenny's Window, which I've always been very fond of. And I've amplified and thickened it out to a movie, a live-action movie, which a number of people are interested in, and I'm hoping will get published. It's the same theme. It's my one Johnny One No theme. Children caught up in adversity for a moment and how they deal with it. That's the theme of all my books. But this is sort of a comedy, too. And now I'm also working on a screenplay based on Dear Millie, another live-action movie, which, to reassure anybody listening, that I'm not stretching a 10-minute fairy tale into an hour-and-a-half musical. The fairy tale will take about 10 minutes of the film. The rest of the movie is about an incident in Wilhelm's life, which is based on fact, but which is purely invented, and how it leads, this moment in his life leads him to enact this fairy tale later in the film. I'm working on three operas, Idomeneo by Mozart, La Clemenza di Tito by Mozart, which will be arranged, hopefully will be produced in his anniversary year, 1991, anniversary of his death, and Hansel and Gretel by Humperdinck. So there's a lot on the drawing table right now.
Well, it's been a real pleasure to have you here, and I thank you very much for talking.
I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
Maurice Sendak's latest book, Dear Millie, is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. His other books include Outside Over There, In the Night Kitchen, Higgledy Piggledy Pop, and Where the Wild Things Are, which won a Caldecott Medal. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with Penn Jillette, the talking half of the magic duo Penn and Teller. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss Cohen with Fresh Air. I'm filling in today while Terry Gross attends the annual public radio conference. Poet Richard Wilbur is a master craftsman whose works have earned him two Pulitzer Prizes and a congressional appointment as Poet Laureate of the United States. Coming up, a talk with Richard Wilbur. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Big Daddy, the new album from John Cougar Mellencamp. And we check in with Fresh Air film critic Stephen Schiff, who's attending this year's Cannes Film Festival in France. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Brian Naylor. The Supreme Court today cleared the way for a 15-year-old Florida girl to obtain an abortion without the consent of her parents or a judge. The justices, without comment, lifted an order Justice Anthony Kennedy issued 2 days earlier, blocking a Lake Country girl, a county girl, from undergoing the procedure. The action today was a procedural one and not a ruling on the merits of the case or the constitutionality of the Florida law. Murder charges were dropped today against a Chicago-area man who entered a hospital with a gun and disconnected his infant son's life support. NPR's Cheryl Duvall reports.
Cook County prosecutors and the county grand jury decided today not to pursue murder charges against Rudy Linares, who just over 3 weeks ago turned off his son's respirator while holding employees of a Chicago hospital at bay with a .357 Magnum. Linares pleaded guilty today to unlawful use of a weapon, but expressed relief after a county circuit judge determined that he would not have to serve jail time on that misdemeanor charge. Friends, neighbors, and people the 23-year-old Cicero man had never met have rallied around him since the hospital incident, saying that Linares was right to end life support for his son. The 15-month-old boy lapsed into an irreversible coma last summer after he swallowed a balloon. In Chicago, I'm Cheryl Duvall reporting.
President Bush traveled to Rochester, New York today to address employees of the Eastman Kodak Company. Bush came to praise the photography giant and its cooperation with community groups and schools on the problems of American education. Bud Lowell of member station WXXI reports.
President Bush says partnership between schools and the private sector can help education to help America. And he says the Brain Power program operated between Kodak and the Rochester School District shows how, by sending a powerful message to teachers and students.
If you excel now in school, we'll give you a job when you graduate from school. And another program vows if you hit the books, local companies will offer college scholarship aid. A third program helps the teachers. God bless the teachers, and helps them hone their skills.
The president says the private sector has the resources and the responsibility to make sure our children can read, write, and understand new technologies. And he says he is challenging business and academia to form brain power style partnerships to make America more productive. For National Public Radio, Bud Lowell in Rochester.
The Bush administration got some support from French President François Mitterrand today in its dispute with West Germany over short-range nuclear missiles. Mitterrand, who meets this weekend with President Bush, says there should not be talks on limiting the short-range weapons while the Soviet Union holds an overwhelming advantage in conventional forces. West Germany's defense minister met with the Bush administration officials today. Amid reports, the Bonn government is showing some flexibility on the timing of the proposed talks. But administration officials say the White House has not changed its stance on the matter. The British government has tipped airlines using British airports to be on the lookout for containers of a Middle Eastern candy that could conceal bombs. The alert came after a package of candy was found to contain Semtex, a plastic explosive. British newspapers identified the candy as halwa and said it is similar in color and texture to the Czechoslovak-made explosive. The Chinese government warned demonstrators today that it is prepared to get tough to end continuing protests throughout the country. Foreign defense attachés and Chinese journalists said it was possible the authorities would soon summon troops to clear Tiananmen Square to end what Premier Li Peng referred to as a state of anarchy. For the second straight day, more than a million demonstrators marched through the heart of Beijing, demanding democratic reforms. The State Department issued a travel alert today for U.S. citizens traveling in China, but did not forbid travel. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. John Cougar Mellencamp has a new album out called Big Daddy. Rock critic Ken Tucker has this review.
Never wanted to be no pop singer. Never wanted to write no pop song. Never had no weird hair to get my songs over. Never wanted to hang out after the show.
The first single from John Cougar Mellencamp's new album, Big Daddy, is called Pop Singer, and it sounds like a lot of other Mellencamp songs, such as Crumblin' Down and Paper in Fire. In that sense, it was a logical choice to release as a single. On rock radio stations, familiarity breeds record sales, but initially, at least, it's a disappointment. But listen to a little more of it, and then I'll tell you why I'm hooked on it. What I like about this song, the more I hear it, is its various contradictions. He moans, never wanted to be no pop singer, never wanted to write no pop songs. It's an extremely annoying idea, a big rock star complaining about his own stardom. And for Pete's sake, this is the guy who let his manager name him Johnny Cougar at the start of his career, so at some point he did want to be a pop star. But the song works as music. It's catchy, and the way he overpronunciates the word pop gives the song its musical hook. But what about that lyric? In a very revealing interview he gave recently to the New York Times, Mellencamp said that Pop Singer is, quote, a song about how I don't like living in a pop culture. I don't think art was supposed to lie down with commerce as much as it has. You write something you think is important, but then it's printed next to a fashion layout. This, it seems to me, is as limited and naive as many of the well-meaning sentiments that Mellencamp expresses in his lyrics on this album, which includes sentimental hymns to the homeless and a lazy swipe at Ronald Reagan. I always thought the whole idea of pop culture is that it's supposed to be popular, and the way you make large numbers of people aware of your work is through mass production, which inevitably involves commerce. A lot of us believe that a piece of art intended for a mass audience gains something by being juxtaposed next to a fashion layout. I think that if Mellencamp is upset about all this, he really ought to stop making music videos, stop having glamorous, soft-focused pictures of himself pasted onto his album covers, and maybe think about buying himself a good tape dubbing machine so he can pass out his own cassettes of his work and bypass that commerce he professes to despise. All that said, and as wrong-headed as he is, I still find his song charming. In fact, there's quite a bit that's charming on this album. Where Mellencamp's anti-pop ideas work for him is not in the lyrics, but in the music, where it translates into an emphasis on loudly played acoustic instruments and the contrast between slamming drums, accordions, fiddles, and penny whistles.
Martha says you don't need no stinking man making no decisions for her. She don't need his money. She don't need him between the sheets. She ain't gonna sleep on the edge of the bed for no stinking man. That's the way that she lives. Cause I saw her last night pouring water on a drowned man in the moonlight saying, howdy, 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 brother. Howdy, howdy, hey, now, mother. Howdy, 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 sister. Say what, hey, you, look out, mother. Martha says she don't need no revolver to shoot some idiot down. Walking down the hall. Man, now ain't that the truth? Cause I saw her take a bite. That's a macho dude laying some cornball line on her last night. Say, howdy, howdy, howdy.
That's Martha Say. I don't want you to leave this review thinking I'm dumping on this awfully sincere fellow. Existing in the same world as unaccountably popular acts like Bon Jovi and Mike and the Mechanics, Mellencamp's faith in roughness and spontaneity and forthright emotions is admirable. I guess I just wish that his stylistic primitivism wasn't matched by his thinking, and that he had more of a sense of humor. Still, earnestness as pure as this counts for something these days.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
No trespassing to blow your brains out into it with an atomic bomb. They're cutting down rainforests, this food is fattening, and I hope there's no satanic message in this song. But it's live and farmy and all kind of hanging this to heaven's eye.
This is Fresh Air. Richard Wilbur has written poetry for more than 40 years. During that time, he has won the National Book Award and two Pulitzer Prizes, the latest for an anthology of his work called New and Collected Poems, which is published by Harcourt Brace and Jovanovich. From 1987 until 1988, he served as Second Poet Laureate of the United States, a post established by Congress in 1985. While unconventional styles of poetry have emerged over the years, Wilbur has remained consistent, using a more traditional form of writing. His work has been praised for its precision and its gentle elegance. I asked Richard Wilbur to read one of his earlier poems.
This is a poem about my daughter. My daughter has by now turned into a very fine and recognized writer of short stories. But she was always writing short stories, and this poem looks back at her as she was in her high school days. The writer. In her room at the prow of the house, where light breaks and the windows are tossed with linden, my daughter is writing a story. I pause in the stairwell, hearing from her shut door a commotion of typewriter keys like a chain hauled over a gunwale. Young as she is, the stuff of her life is a great cargo, and some of it heavy. I wish her a lucky passage. But now it is she who pauses, as if to reject my thought and its easy figure. A stillness gratens in which the whole house seems to be thinking. And then she is at it again with a bunched clamor of strokes, and again is silent. I remember the dazed starling which was trapped in that very room 2 years ago. How we stole in, lifted a sash, and retreated, not to affright it. And how for a helpless hour, through the crack of the door, we watched the sleek, wild, dark, and iridescent creature batter against the brilliance, drop like a glove to the hard floor or the desk top, and wait then, humped and bloody, for the wits to try it again. And how our spirits rose when, suddenly sure, it lifted off from a chair back, beating a smooth course for the right window and clearing the sill of the world. It is always a matter, my darling, of life or death, as I had forgotten. I wish what I wished you before, but harder.
As I listen to your poems, either you reading them or myself reading them to myself, there is a kind of the flow and the sound of the words. Makes me wonder whether you work out loud or work quietly when you are actually writing a poem.
You know, when I began to write, poetry in earnest back in the 1940s. The oral performance of poetry was relatively uncommon. And so I think that my first poems were written as if for the page, and is they were written to be taken off the page by the eye. And a lot of them are rather hard to sound aloud, I find. Since then, I've been involved in the theater, and more, like everybody else, I've been giving poetry readings here and there across the nation. By now, the poems I write are easy to pronounce, easy to perform. They are at least 50% pieces of oral art.
You actually began to write, and my understanding is during World War II. And
I began to take it seriously at that time.
Was there something about, I suppose, being a young man, being, I think, probably afraid, alone in war, that somehow the poetry grew out of that? I mean, your seriousness about poetry?
Yes. I think I felt that I began to take poetry seriously. For one thing, because it was one of the few constructive things I could do with the long periods of idleness which military service involves. Writing poems was something to do, that and reading. And then there was the general disorder and doubtfulness of the world. We didn't know when our war against Adolf Hitler began that we were going to beat him.
Yeah.
We might have lived in a Hitler world 4 years thereafter, for all we knew. And then there was the interior disturbance which even the bravest and securest of us felt at such a time. And all of that leads to art. All of that leads to the tendency of art to not to make things look nicer than they are, but to face up to things, to clarify.
Did you feel yourself becoming a poet?
Well,
whatever that is.
It's very hard to say when you decide that you are a poet. I knew that I was someone to whom writing poems was important. I don't suppose that I really felt that I was a poet until the day came when a New York publisher wrote me and said, we'd like to publish a book of this stuff.
Hmm.
Or perhaps it was a little earlier when, for the first time, two or three people said to me that this or that poem had mattered greatly to them, had helped them take hold of their own lives a bit.
Hmm.
About that time, you begin to think that what you're doing is going to be useful to other people in some way, and you then feel entitled to take yourself seriously.
And you can call yourself a poet.
About
then.
That time,
when
you
others
call
you
a
that,
poet.
Then I guess you can call
yes.
yourself that.
Yes. When others say, write me another poem, I liked the last one. I needed the last one.
I know that you had a young son who became autistic at the age of about 2.5.
Mm-hmm.
And I think how sad that must be. I mean, certainly for any parent, but I think of especially you because of the way you wrote about kind of being in the world and the beauty of language to you, and to have a child, I suppose, who's lost to your world that way.
Well, he was lost initially. Actually, of course, autistic children show their special symptoms from birth.
Yeah.
There were long periods in which he was on strike, wouldn't speak, wouldn't eat. Very long periods.
It's interesting you say on strike.
Yes, that's what it felt like. He felt very obdurate. At last, it's just a great mercy that he came around, proved educable, and proved to be sweet-natured and happy.
Mm.
And he's, whatever it is to lead a life, he is in great part leading a good life now. There was a lot of anguish in it for us before it became clear that he was going to be capable of a life.
I know you've written for children, and I think a title which I love is Loud Mouse.
Mm-hmm.
And The Game of Opposites, which was a game you used to play with your family.
Yes.
How did that work?
Somebody at the table would say, what is the opposite of Earth? And someone else would say, sky. And someone else would say, no, heaven. And, well, there are perhaps three or four other possible answers to it. But waiting around to think of another opposite had a very quieting and civilizing effect on our dinner tables. And it was fun. I found myself some time after our children had mostly gone away, scribbling little poems based on this game in the margins of graver efforts. And after a while, it turned out that I had 39 of them and could declare it a book. And happily, my publisher agreed. They even let me draw the pictures for
it. And the pictures are great.
Well, I'm glad you like them. They're not professional art, of course, but I think they're probably well attuned to the poems. Professional art would probably overpower those little poems.
Yeah. Richard Wilbur just won the Pulitzer Prize for his book New and Collected Poems, which is published by Harcourt Brace Jovanovich. He was Poet Laureate of the United States from 1987 until 1988. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up, and co-host Noah Adams has joined us. Noah, what do you have for us from China?
Hi, Marty. Once again, China is the lead story. Another million people or so in Beijing's Tiananmen Square. The workers have joined the students there. And Premier Li Peng has met with some of the hunger strikers. That meeting's been shown on television. In New Jersey, at the Exxon board meeting, there's been a challenge to Exxon's management from environmentalists, including demands that the chairman, Lawrence Rawl, resign. He says he won't do that. Letters from listeners tonight about Panama and Winnie the Pooh. And also, a story about Michael Jordan of the basketball team, the Chicago Bulls. Does he or does he not hang in the air longer than most basketball players?
Okay, Noah, thanks. Those stories and more coming up later on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
The Cannes Film Festival in France is in full swing. Fresh Air's film critic Stephen Schiff has joined us from Cannes to give us an insider's perspective. Stephen, tell us a little bit about what Cannes looks like.
Well, Cannes is a very beautiful, slightly glitzy, slightly built-up resort town on the Riviera that becomes this maze of movie posters, tourists, insane-looking people. There's a man walking around on the beach now dressed up as the Toxic Avenger, and he's got with him this extremely voluptuous girl who's not very dressed. And there are people, there's a guy who has a, you know, Jesus is coming sign everywhere, and you can never tell whether he means a movie or the real thing. It really is absolutely like no place else in the world.
So have you spent all your time in darkened theaters? Here you are on the coast of southern France. And
you know, the first con in recent memory that had good weather every day so far, and yet we do trudge into the darkened theaters and, you know, come out blinking at the sun and feeling a little stupid about, you know, feeling so... You wind up going to movies here that you wouldn't cross the street for back home, and sometimes you sort of wonder what it's all about.
What is the range of movies that you've seen, from the best to the worst?
There are amazing movies here because, you see, it's not just a competition. There's also the market. For instance, the company called Troma gets the best titles. For instance, this year they have a movie called Stuff Stephanie in the Incinerator, which I must admit to not having seen, and perhaps it's not even been made yet. Maybe they're just selling the title. The best movie I've seen so far is one by an Australian director making her first full-length feature. Her name is Jane Campion, and the movie is called Sweetie. I loved it. I saw it last night. The French booed and hissed. As I think they would have booed and hissed when they first saw Blue Velvet. It has that kind of grit, although it's a very different sort of movie.
I imagine that this gives you a chance to meet with your colleagues around the world. What is that like?
Well, it is fun because as different as our opinions and approaches are, we are all people who are very passionate about movies. On the other hand, you know, you see these press conferences and you get some very, very weird approaches to movies. The weirdest for me, of course, are the French. In fact, I wrote down a translation of what one guy asked Fred Skepsy, the director of A Cry in the Dark, which is that movie about Meryl Streep's child getting taken away by a dingo, a wild dog in Australia. This French critic asked, "Monsieur Skepsy, I would like to ask you a question about the way in which you portray the dingo. Now, in the history of cinema, and here one thinks above all of Rin Tin Tin and Lassie, the dog has been seen as a domesticated creature and at the same time as a narrative motor. Now, in your film, the dingo is portrayed as an embodiment of evil, but at the same time as a creature which represents the way in which Western man has destroyed the environment. And this, of course, belongs to the tradition of John Ford and his ambiguous relationship with the cowboy and the Indian, so that your film is part of the mythic movement in cinema."
Well, I guess it shows you there's a fine line between passion and lunacy.
Exactly right.
Tell us a little bit about some of the shallow stuff. I mean, what are people wearing? Who have you seen? Is this a place where you can do some stargazing?
Well, it's not a great place for American movie stars. And a typical scene at Cannes is you see a huge, huge crowd, and they're gathered in front of what must be a movie star. And you try to stick your head in, and you say, "Who's that star?" You get a name you never heard of. You say, "What films has the star been in?" You get names you never heard of. You say, "What country is the star from?" You get a name you never heard of. So it's a little like that.
Well, look, I hope, Stephen, you get outside, you get a little swimming in the Mediterranean and enjoy.
I'm headed for my yacht right now.
Thanks a lot. Then Stephen Schiff is also a film critic for Vanity Fair and a contributing correspondent for West 57th. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, we meet detective writer Elmore Leonard, author of the bestsellers Glitz, Freaky Deaky, and his latest called Kill Shot. Also, New Orleans pianist Harry Connick Jr. joins us in our weekly performance spot, and critic Ken Tucker reviews the home video version of Tougher Than Leather, starring the members of the rap group Run DMC. So hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Amy Sallet, and Ed Dougherty. Production assistance from Lisa Bruton and Deborah Beagle. Research assistance from Christopher Cook and Laura Civitz. Our engineer is Thad Kirk. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.